Okay, our next presenters are David Legvold and Claire Hinther. David is a farmer from Southern Dakota County, and on his farm he uses restorative farming practices, and he has sort of led the way in a number of different farming practices. His farm is a Minnesota Agricultural Water Quality Certified operation. David was named by Governor Dayton as one of three Minnesota water heroes, and he has led a number of other conferences and tours of his farm demonstrating various agricultural practices. Claire is a student from St. Olaf College in Northfield, and she has been working with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture to develop research protocols around saturated buffer technology. She is in environmental studies and political science, major, and plans to graduate in 2019 spring. Welcome. And so just to finish it off here, their presentation is, do saturated buffers work? Functionality of saturated buffers for nitrogen abatement in tile water.
Thank you very much. Not too long ago, I didn't know what a saturated buffer was. I knew the word buffers, I knew the word saturated, but how they fit together, I really had no idea. Until Mark Dietrich from Minnesota Department of Agriculture visited my farm and said, would you like a saturated buffer? And so we came up with one in connection with the Conservation Technology Information Center from Indiana in their national tour called Conservation in Action, and they wanted to visit one of these things. So my learning curve was pretty fast. So what's the fuss about buffers? Well, if you look at this picture, you can probably see what the fuss is all about. We have cropland way too close to a tributary. We have herbicide that has been applied to the bank and probably oversprayed onto the water, which is totally against labeled instructions. This particular stream flows right between the boundary of the Big Woods prairie area of Minnesota and the karst topography near the small town of Denison, Minnesota. I took this photo, wrote a letter to Rice County and said, we need to do something about this, and came back the next year. Not too much improvement, maybe a little less herbicide burn down, but still the need for buffer placement in our state was very apparent when we had areas like this. So I farm in both Dakota and Rice County. There is a rather stark difference between the implementation of the buffers. In Dakota County, during this time, it was 99.6 compliant. Reason being, Dakota County implemented its own buffer regulations and you could call it enforcement, but it was really cooperation with landowners to get the job done. Rice County was barely 60% compliant. Reason being, as a staff person put it at a meeting in Rochester, very little political support for buffers in Rice County, which meant when we leave it to local government, county commissioners, etc., it's a matter of political and resolve in their hearts. So taking a look at the need for buffers, we have cultivated land that is pretty close to some of our tributaries. If we take a look at it, we have some vegetation on the bank, but then there's those things called open doors where overflow can go right into the stream. If we put in a 25-foot buffer, you'll notice that it will stop about 78% of the total sediment loss, and that's how it looks. So if we look at the 50-foot, a 50-foot buffer would extend it out quite a ways, and that would stop about 87% of the total sediment loss, plus a good share of the nutrient would be stopped also, about a 50% reduction. So this is what it looks like. Looks pretty good, doesn't it? Who can tell me what is really wrong with this picture? Pardon me? Tile flow through the buffer. Could be. There's something else. Well, if you look at the color of the soil, maybe that'll be a clue. Yes, bare soil. Thank you, sir. Totally disaggregated soil through tillage has loosened the soil so that it could easily wash away, could easily blow away. And the act of tillage destroys the organic matter which would hold water in the soil rather than letting it slough off. So, in case you haven't guessed it, I have tipped my agricultural hand to you. I'm not much in favor of total black tillage. So the 50-foot standard for county and state, it's the most effective for the least space. If we have a quarter mile of 50-foot buffer, it takes about 1.5 acres. And that's not going to make too much difference in my bottom line. It's only 1.5 acres. And it's the law. Now, when it came to the buffer thing, Governor Dayton brought his staff, and we had a symposium on our farm where he rolled out the buffer proposals, and we had many speakers, many people who contributed, some for, some against, but still, it was the beginning of the rollout of the buffer legislation. But that leads us to a question about nitrogen. Nitrogen is a huge challenge for our agricultural system in Minnesota. It's necessary for crops, but it does have serious environmental liabilities. Larkin McPhee, who was a movie producer, she produced the movie Troubled Waters about Minnesota, a great film. She characterized our agricultural system as being leaky nutrient system. And end transfer to surface and groundwater is a matter of how we manage soil. Not so much legislation, not so much rate application and that stuff, but what's going on with our soil health. So this is an ordinary buffer on my farm. It's about 75 feet wide, and you can see it's between cropland. The cropland that you see has been in no-till agriculture for about 20-some years. And you'll notice that it's pretty flat. This buffer has about 3.5 to 4 feet of rich black soil because this is located in what was the Great Greenvale Slough until they straightened the creeks and allowed drainage. Below that, there is a gravelly layer, little stones about the size of the end of my little finger, and that's probably a couple of feet deep. After that, it's glacial till down to about 60 feet when we reach the dolomitic limestone, which is a wonderful transmitter of nutrients. The stream that it runs next to has an illustrious name. It's just called Mud Creek. And Mud Creek usually runs pretty clear because it is very well buffered about 3 or 4 miles upstream from where we're looking at this. In heavy precipitation events, of course, the sediment in the system gets pretty well stirred up. So what about tile water? Typically, tile water is pretty clear, very little TSS in it, and it's the unseen nutrient load that is of concern. And so what I've done is to bring along two bottles. One contains unopened spring water from your local holiday store. The other is tile water that was collected yesterday. Pardon me? No, we're not going to ask you to drink this stuff to find out what it is.
although you probably could. But just for fun, why don't you take these two bottles, pass them around, see if you can determine which is the tile water, which is spring water from your holiday store. And please don't cheat by opening it and tasting it. So the tile water that we see being expressed from a lot of our land is really pretty clean as you look at it, but it does contain nutrient.
So on my farms, I try to practice drainage water management. That allows me to tinker with the release of tile drainage water based on the seasonality of what's going on. So in the winter, I raise the gates and hold the water back in the soil. And that holds not only water, but it holds nutrient, keeps it in the land where perhaps it belongs. In the spring, when I want to, In the spring, when I want to perform field operations, I release the water, let it go, and that lowers the water table so I don't get stuck. That's always a good thing. In the summertime, I can raise the water level again and make it available to plant roots and available for growth. Again, using the water, managing it. And then in the fall, time for more field operations, then I release the water. Installing these drainage water management devices is really pretty simple. All you need is a backhoe and a couple of guys. And what you do is to cut the tile line, install the structure, level it up, and when it's in place, it takes up practically no cropland. So the issue of losing cropland because of drainage water management is not an issue. And then when you do release the water, we have to pay attention to where we're putting it. And I'm trying to put all of my water into infiltration areas such as wetlands. So, tiling provides an immediate improvement in soil quality and farmability, but it also brings with it some issues. So in this particular photo, you can now see that I have illustrated with the white line where the saturated buffer distribution line is placed. It's a perforated tile. It's placed about 32 inches deep in the soil. And now we're going to work on saturating this land. So the saturated buffer, as you can see from this top view, has a control structure that intercepts the flow from the field coming in from the right. And it diverts the water by raising the water level just enough to force it into that pipe that's 32 inches deep, and shove the water back into the buffer where we have grass growing, and the water can be used by those plants for growth. However, there must be some that is released in overflow, and so we have something called the hydraulic gradient. Water begins to disappear, and we found that by the time the water gets toward the edge of the creek, it has descended a great deal. It's farther down in the soil. And so we have infiltration seeping into the groundwater. That produces a hydraulic gradient decline. We also have evapotranspiration, which brings forward less water in the soil profile. And all of this happens with the three-chambered structure. You can see two white pipes. The two white pipes are, they go to the bottom of the structure in two chambers, and they have transducers so we can measure water flow rather nicely. And we are also able to tinker with the level of the water, how much we force back into the field. And the question is, we have the ability to transmit all of that data to an internet site so we can see what's going on with this almost on a daily basis. So the question is, does the saturation line or the distribution line saturate the buffer? I'll let you decide. It certainly seems to saturate the buffer pretty well. This was on a day when Mark Dietrich and I were tinkering with the water level in the saturated buffer area, and we had raised it up outside of decency limits, and water was about at the same level as the soil, and I inadvertently drove on top of the saturation line and found that that was not a good idea. Fortunately, he was there with a second tractor and a log chain, and that took care of that. All right, so I am gifted as a producer to have a relationship with Carleton and St. Olaf College. And once in a while, a really stellar student comes along and says, I would like to tinker with what's going on in the saturated buffer. So Claire has been working on our farm for the summer, and now you get to look at a younger, fresher face than mine.
All right, so the next few slides here show the progress of the saturated buffer and how it came into being on Dave's farm. So this is in 2014. It's just a regular riparian buffer. Standard water runs through the tie lines and directly into the creek. In 2015, the saturated buffer was implemented. The control structure was put into place, and that whole system started working. September 2016, I don't think any of these changes were actually made, were they? So these were proposed distribution lines. This all happened this summer. We started experimenting with vegetation on the buffer, particularly in the west end. We put in a number of different native woody species, including high bush cranberries and hazel, elderberries, swamp white oak, and a bunch of different native trees. So the goal behind that was to show that saturated buffers don't need to include just grass species. They can include other economically viable options, or they can include just other native species of plants. So looking forward into next summer, we're going to be looking at different types of grass species, shallow-rooted grass species in the east side of the buffer, just for variation's sake. So this is a depiction of some of the structures that we have going on in the buffer. We have the west distribution line, this longer one on the side here, divided up into three equal transects, each of which is a different vegetation transect. And the research that I'm doing is focusing on nitrogen abatement in saturated buffers and looking at how effective they are in terms of reducing nitrogen in water coming off of fields. So we've implemented this set of wells across the buffer. This summer we had all of the level one wells put in, and now we have all of the sets in. So it shows the wells and their locations in the different transects and the wells' depths, which are approximately the depth of the stream at that particular point. So this is what the buffer looks like with the wells in place. They go up approximately to the edge of the stream. They're about every 10 feet or so. And I think every transect is around, I think it's 89.5 feet in width. So we have those throughout, and the goal is to track how nitrogen is abated as it moves from the distribution line towards the creek throughout the course of the buffer. And this is another section of the buffer. You can see some of the trees that we've put in. Oh, I'm using the wrong mouse. Here we go. Okay, so this is a view of the inside of the distribution line, sort of, what was the term we used? Hitchcockish. And it's going along the inside of the distribution line to see what exactly is going on in there. And one of the problems that we encountered was that roots penetrate into the distribution line because it's a perforated tile. And this hasn't been a problem so far, but it's something that we need to bear in mind as we're moving forward, because the whole purpose of the distribution line is to get water to a place where roots can access it and the plants can uptake it. But the question that we're trying to deal with now is how many roots is too many. So that's where it stopped. That was almost all the way through the buffer. So, and we did put a copper wire through. We ran a copper wire through to discourage root growth, and it's still something that's happening. So it's something to keep in mind as we move forward. And these are some of our preliminary results from the samples that we drew. So the samples on the right side of the graph are from the creek itself. Those are drawn from the middle of the creek downstream from the saturated buffer and then just upstream. And also from the origin of the stream about a quarter mile west. The one labeled CS is from the main control structure. So that water is coming directly off of the field. It's just straight tile water. And that's what's sent out throughout the buffer laterally through the distribution lines. So some of these results are a little bit anomalous. Note well E. Don't know what was going on there, but these are just preliminary results, and we're looking to collect more throughout the course of next summer and see if we can find some sort of more reliable trends. But from what this shows, it seems that throughout the course of the buffer in the A through F wells, the nitrogen levels and the nitrogen nitrate levels are pretty noticeably lower than in the control structures. And even in the creek, the nitrogen levels are not as high as you see coming directly off of the fields. So that's an encouraging set of numbers to see. And this is just a little addition. Dave and I conducted a very high-tech experiment involving a coffee can and some water. And we tested this in two different fields. The one in the bottom left was on Dave's field, which has been in no-till for about 2 decades. And we filled both of these coffee cans to about an inch and measured the amount of time it took for all of that water to be absorbed into the soil. The top left picture was taken on a field that has a history of very, very extensive tillage. It's tilled very heavily. It's rolled multiple times to get rid of soil clods. And it clearly takes much longer to absorb the same amount of water. So this is just a reminder that the farming practices that are being used have a really significant impact on soil porosity and its ability to absorb water. And this final slide here, this was a very interesting day for me. It was July 26th. It had rained 5.5 inches in less than 48 hours, and I went out to the field to take some samples, and I was wearing my full bib set of waders that I wore just because I wanted to. And I got out there and I stepped off the gator that I had driven out, and I was up to my ankles in water. And so I went to take some samples from the stream, and since I'd been sampling from the middle of the stream, I thought, well, for consistency's sake, I better do this again. And I couldn't see the bottom of the creek. I had no idea how deep it was. Dave said it's usually pretty clear. That's true, but this day everything was all stirred up. So I took one step in, I was up to my knees, I took one more step in, and I was up to my chest, and it was a pretty exciting experience. Very cold. But the point of this slide is to show, you know, this is on a farm with very low impact tillage, a no-till farm. And if this is the amount of standing water that we're seeing on a saturated buffer that's at capacity, even without extensive tillage, you can imagine the amount of runoff that would be coming off of one of those crops with such intense tillage that doesn't absorb the water anywhere near at the same level as this. So while the saturated buffer might be a very viable option for mitigation of runoff from fields and nitrogen and nitrates, it's not the solution. It's just a method of mitigation, and really the way to address it is to address it at the source in farming practices. And with that, I think we will open it up to questions. Thank you.
Yeah, I was curious. I'm assuming your general goal and kind of hypothesis for nitrate removal within the saturated buffer is plant uptake, but it sounds like there's a lot of natural organic matter in the soil. And I'm curious if you're looking at denitrification, did you look at TOC in the water or molecular hydrogen levels or something like that to get a feel for how much bacterial denitrification was going on in the saturated soils?
Yes, that soil is about 7.5 to 8% organic matter. It's okay. It's the leftovers of the Great Slough, so it's nice, deep, rich, high organic soil that facilitates nitrogen processing. Mm-hmm.
So Dave, I was just wondering, with the no-till, is your production, is it is equal to what other farmers with their tilling? I mean, how does that compare?
That question comes up for me a lot. And there's some sources of information. One source is the coffee shop discussion. Well, what was your yield? And if they say, well, it was 225 bushels, in my mind, I usually multiply that times 0.82, which is, I call it the LWF, the lying weasel factor. I generally document my yields, and I find that they are comparable and getting better and better as the soil becomes better. And so I watch the yield monitor on my combine like a hawk. And in years past, I've been blessed with Carleton students and St. Olaf students who have done nitrogen trials where we vary the rates of nitrogen and see what happens to the economic return as well as the yield. And so that's pretty pure data. I don't tinker with that. No 0.82 business there at all. And it does prove that if you improve the quality of the soil, you can use less fertilizer and still maintain yields.
Does no-till work for all soils? I mean, pretty much, or are there some limitations?
That's another nasty question. I've had many farmers say, you know, my soil is so tight, I have to do some kind of tillage. And if you think ahead, the reason perhaps that the soil is so tight is because it has been tilled, and that tends to enhance the process of compaction. So if you just leave it alone, let it heal, let it develop its own natural processes, that will happen. But farmers are kind of an impatient lot. And I have a good friend who's a neighbor who said, you know, it's clear in the fall when the weather is nice, farmers just like to go out and do, and they do.
I was curious, Dave, you're a farmer, but you're a tinkerer too, and maybe a Renaissance man. What's your background? What are some of your interests outside of farming?
Well, my background was in education, public school education. I retired from that and became education director at an environmental learning center. I didn't retire from that. I retired to something else. I also worked for the John Deere Company for 8 years, and then I was executive director of the Cannon River Watershed Partnership, and now it's my pleasure just to work with my research colleague, Claire. I think that's about the best job ever.
I have a question regarding cover crop. I see the Minnesota Department of Agriculture has sent out lots of information on cover crops. Have you experimented at all with any cover crops on that acreage?
Well, I think we're beyond the experimentation phase. Dr. Kathy Shea at St. Olaf has students who want to explore cover crops, and so my son, who is beginning to tinker with farming, has invented a wonderful way to apply cover crop seed in a corn crop that's about perhaps 2 feet tall while we put on the last dose of nitrogen fertilizer. Just when the corn is really going to use it, we put on the nitrogen and we distribute cover crop seed at the same time. And in the fall, when the corn dies back, the cover crop just takes off. And so we have this kind of a nice green carpet in the cornfields. Not all acres, but many acres that we want to experiment with and that Dr. Shea wants her students to experiment with. Pardon me? No, I don't. I like ryegrass. I mean, it works well. You know, there's a lot of cocktail mixes. You know, some people say you got to use rapeseed, you got to use hairy vetch, you got to use clover, all kinds of this stuff. But my main objective is to enhance root mass and shield the soil.
I got a question. How many acres do you farm, and have you identified any negative aspects of what you're doing?
I farm about 800 acres. Negative aspects. Can you clarify that a little bit?
Well, for example, you have less weekends to fish because you're tinkering out there. Decrease your crop, I mean your acreage for growing crops on, so you've got to have some of a decrease in your profit. Anything like that?
I think the variability of Mother Nature is always a concern, and farming is always the same year after year after year. Every year is different.
One more.
This is a question for Claire. How did you decide which woody vegetation you were going to do to start with?
So we started just looking at different native species in the areas and types of species that could tolerate wet feet, because the buffer's got a pretty high water table. So we worked with Nancy Breaker, who's the curator of the Carlton Arboretum, and she helped us identify native species that would be viable for that particular habitat.
All right, thank you very much.